This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Early vocal quartets, minstrel singers, as well as blues, country, and jazz performers share the billing in a new 9-CD box set called American Pop, an audio history from minstrel to mojo. My guest is the producer, Alan Lowe, who's also written a companion book of the same name. Lowe's obsession with finding the historical connections between the different strains of pop music connects with the other part of his musical life as a jazz composer and saxophonist. His own music is inspired by a range of genres and draws on the past and the avant-garde. Many of the recordings highlighted in Alan Lowe's new pop history are comparatively obscure. That was intentional on his part. I asked him why.
There's so many things that have kind of passed down by rote. Somebody said them, and then somebody repeated them. And as they get repeated generation by generation, they achieve a kind of truth based on, not necessarily on their relationship to reality and to fact, but a truth based on the fact that they just happen to be there, you know, for so many generations, and everybody says it, so it must be true. So consequently, my feeling was that if I'm going to really examine this stuff, I must get out of the circle, of the tight circle of what everyone is always examining, what everyone is always reading, what everyone is always saying, and what everyone is always listening to.
Let's listen to a recording that's on your American Pop anthology, and it's a recording that I would bet very few of our listeners have heard. I know I never heard it until listening to your compilation, and this features Polk Miller and the Old South Quartet. Tell us about this recording and why you've chosen to play it for us.
Sure. I want to mention just quickly that I'm in debt to a very fine writer and researcher named Doug Seroff, who's written about this particular recording. And much of what I say here is a reflection of Seroff's observations on this. Listening to this recording is probably about as close as we can get to being in 1840s plantation life. This is a song that has all the aspects of early American populist song as they later became filtered through many other areas. It's really one of the earliest of minstrel-type songs. It's a wild plantation fantasy. It's these slaves sitting around in probably 1840, 1850, and fantasizing about having oysters and wine at 2 a.m., and it's devoid of any kind of the demeaning racialisms that are in a lot of later minstrelsy, and it's just a very, very powerful and very, very funny look, as well as just being a very accurate picture, most likely, of the kind of music that was being done before we recorded American music.
The recording we're going to hear, though, was made in 1928. This was the second time, I believe, that this group recorded the song.
Right. They recorded it in 1909. That recording, however, there is not a good version or a clean version in existence. This is just a very clear and very, very clean copy of it made from 1928.
So the group is billed as Polk Miller and the Old South Quartet. Tell us something about the singers we're listening to on this track.
Okay. The Old South Quartet was essentially an African-American minstrel quartet that toured various venues, particularly in the South, but also in the North, I believe from the late 1800s on. They were led by a man named Polk Miller, who was a white Southerner who had grown up on a plantation with slaves. I believe his father was a slave owner and had learned much of his music. He was a banjo player, but also much of his folklore firsthand from slaves. As a matter of fact, he was praised by none other than Mark Twain as being one of the finest sources of quote-unquote authentic slave lore. And as I said, Miller traveled with these guys throughout, I think, the late 1800s, early 1900s. By the time this recording was made in 1928, he was no longer on the scene. And I don't remember if he just wasn't around. He probably was dead by then. But the group carried on with his name. It's kind of like the Glenn Miller Orchestra after Glenn Miller has died because he was, I think, they were known as that, and they kept carrying on. It's really basically a quartet of four black singers and guitarists.
Well, let's hear it. This is the Old South Quartet, recorded in
1928. Did it kill a peasant? Did it have charms? Did it kill something to keep us so long? Did it kill a province most fortunate and grand? Now watch my music and shall I laugh?
La 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 la.
Oh,
la 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 la. La la.
Oh,
la 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 la. la 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 la.
That's the Old South Quartet, recorded in 1928, one of the recordings featured on Alan Lowe's new anthology, American Pop and Audio History, From Minstrel to Mojo, 1893 to 1946. You know what's kind of particularly entertaining in that recording? The laughing and the lip noises, all the kind of hokum in the middle there. Is that kind of a typical sound for that period?
It likely is. I mean, there's no really way of knowing. That part of singing, it's very interesting. It makes me, as soon as you said that, hokum, I thought of Fats Waller. Many people listen to Fats Waller in certain kinds of African-American recordings and think, oh, it's demeaning. They're making these weird noises. They're saying silly jokes. But that particular kind of tradition was very much a part of the performance style of African-American musicians, I believe from the antebellum period on. Minstrelsy, which really took that and dealt with it in very racially demeaning ways, certainly grew, I think, from that attitude, from that sort of hip asides, the fact that the performer is in on the joke with the audience. I think we hear that line of minstrelsy in both Louis Armstrong and Fats Waller and some other, Louis Jordan and a lot of African-American performers of the 20th century.
There's another recording from the 20s that I'd love to get in here. And it's, I believe, the original recording of Lovesick Blues, the song that most people associate with Hank Williams. Right. But this recording, made in 1928, is by Emmett Miller. Tell us about this recording, Alan, and why you featured it in your pop history.
Yeah, just for the historical record, it's actually Miller's second recording of this particular tune. I believe he recorded it several years earlier as well. This is, the slightly better known one. It's the more available. You know, I talk about Emmett Miller in the book, and I say that he's one of those guys that is, you know, kind of too far out for the liberals and too strange for the purists. One issue that I deal with a lot in the book is minstrelsy. And to me, you know, if you were going to draw one of those annoying family trees about where music comes from and country music and jazz, almost every kind of music would be drawn, the line would go through minstrelsy. I believe minstrelsy connects country music. It connects professional pop music like Tin Pan Alley. I believe it connects jazz. I believe it connects, you know, what we consider folk music. And Miller, to me, was one of the great exemplary minstrels who represented both the best and the worst of minstrelsy. Certainly, as we listen to this recording 70 years later, we're a little embarrassed by the dialect, the use of dialect, which was very common in the 1920s on not only this kind of recording, but on pop music recordings and everything else like that. But minstrelsy had the sort of sense of what I call educated fun.
Well, what is minstrelsy?
Minstrelsy, at least as the term we're using it, I mean, the term itself is a complicated dictionary term, but as we're using it, describes what was basically probably the earliest form of American popular entertainment that arose in the 1840s as the first form for the working man in America. In many ways, it was a response to American music's tendency to be a kind of polite parlor music filled with hearken here and hearken thou, and a lot of, sick ladies in distress and dying women, you know, who were married for 3 days to their noble husband before he died. But minstrelsy, in a way, was a way of saying, enough of this kind of silly effete style. Let's deal with life as it is. And in essence, that's really what it was in the early theatrical sense in about 1840.
And then it developed into a performance style which included blackface and dialect.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, the blackface was there from the beginning. And from the beginning, also, there's been a lot of arguments about how much white minstrels got from black musicians, how much they took themselves. Clearly, it was at least in a white imagining of black styles, if not an authentic reflection of black styles.
You're saying so much of pop music intersects in some way with minstrelsy, and yet minstrelsy is such a politically charged, complicated area to deal with because so many of the minstrel performers sang in blackface. It's something that is really offensive to think about. So are you trying to listen to the music and consider it as music and see how the music itself holds up?
Well, minstrelsy itself changed very much through the years. Strangely enough, in early minstrelsies, there were actually abolitionist thoughts expressed. And apparently, as the Civil War got closer, the minstrels felt a little threatened by the thought of freeing the slaves, and it became a little more racialist, a little more racist, and a little bit more rapidly stereotyped. And of course, the minstrelsy we tend to know better is that which came up in the 1880s and 1890s, which grew more and more rabid in its making fun of African Americans. But my only point is really that it's a complicated situation. I mean, matter of fact, in the 1880s, you start seeing black minstrel troops who often had to black up themselves. As a matter of fact, Burt Williams, who you know well, often, if not always, almost always performed in blackface. So my only real point here is that minstrelsy is neither A nor B. It's really sort of a combination of a lot of different things. It's very different things at different times in its history.
So the 1928 Emmett Miller recording we're going to hear, he's somebody who performed in blackface. Mm-hmm. He's the person who originated the song Lovesick Blues. Do you like this recording we're going to hear?
I think it's a wonderful record. I think Miller is one of those performers whose personality just comes through in the medium of recording, even one as old as 70 years old. He just is a very, very clear performer. And a humorous performer as well. He's an excellent singer who was among the first. You'll hear him do this little yodel, and it's believed by many people, though the lineage is really hard to trace, that Jimmy Rogers, who was considered the great blue yodeler, may very well have learned his yodel from Emmett Miller.
Okay, this is Emmett Miller recorded in 1928.
I'm in love with a beautiful gal. That's what's the matter with me. I'm in love with a beautiful gal, but she don't care about me. To make her love me, I tried, Lord, I was sad and I cried, but she just refused. And ever since my mama's gone away, I've got them lovesick blues. I got a feeling called a blues since my mama said goodbye. It seems I don't know what to do, do, do. All I do is sit and cry. Oh, Lord, the last long day.
My guest is Alan Lowe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Alan Lowe, he's compiled a new 9-CD box set and a companion book called American Pop. Let's move on to another recording from your new CD collection. And the next one up is Hoagy Carmichael with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. And the song is Washboard Blues. Why did you choose to play this one for us?
You know, this is one of my favorite recordings on a personal level. I love this recording, but I think it has musical and historical significance as well. Here we have a music, jazz, which is barely 10 years old in a commercial sense. I mean, it was first recorded about 1917. This is 1927. And here we have a group of white musicians who are clearly learning this secondhand. I mean, they're not, they're not privy to certain of the kind of the social and environments that really caused the music to grow in the African-American community. But they've already, at this early date, have really established their own style. And it's a style that I believe will rub off on many forms of white American pop in the years to come. And this also applies to the Whiteman Band, which was clearly not a jazz band, but which never aspired to be. And the wonderful thing about this recording, it's kind of like a little mini concerto about 40 years before pop musicians thought about doing these kind of, concertos. I was thinking about this last night. You think about, when the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper started doing these kind of multi-connected songs, that went from A to B to C, and they try to sort of use a certain kind of art in their writing and construction of tunes. Well, here is Hoagy Carmichael and the Whiteman Band doing this in 1927.
And the song is Washboard Blues. Let's hear it.
Thank you. cloudy skies and rain. My poor back ain't broke with pain. My man sleeping, Arthur scrubbing, chilling, weeping, Arthur rubbing, pains are creeping, clothes are tubbing all day long. Up to that washing soap and down to that what I once moaned. Head down low, head low. Up to that washing soap and down to that what I once moaned. Poor hands go, oh Lordy. So weary, a scrubbing, days dreary. So weary, up tubbing them clothes. Up to that washing soap and down to that what I once moaned. Washboard blue. Never get me gone from here. Scrub them dirty clothes.
That's Hoagy Carmichael, recorded in 1927 with Paul Whiteman and his orchestra, one of the recordings featured on Alan Lowe's new 9-CD compilation, American Pop and Audio History. Let's move on to another selection from your new anthology that you're going to play for us. And this is a really interesting blues singer named Geechee Wiley. Mm. We're going to hear a 1930 recording. She is not a well-known blues singer, not one of the people in the kind of pantheon up there with Bessie Smith. Tell me why you've chosen to play her for us today and
sure.
why she has a place on your new audio history.
This is just a very striking recording. You know, and we have stereotypes about the kind of music we expect black musicians to play in the 1920s and 1930s. As a matter of fact, one of the big problems we have in trying to examine the history of music through recordings is that producers at the time were very much prescribing the kind of music that they wanted black musicians to play. The market was blues. They wanted the sort of guitar and vocals with blues. In spite of this, many, many black singers managed to kind of do songs that really defy the stereotypes, that defy the kind of market values that the producers were trying to do. Here we have a tune which is just, it's a different tune. It's got a nice minor mode feeling. It's beautifully sung, and it just doesn't fit into the usual historical niches, you know, that we're used to.
How come Geechee Wiley isn't better known?
Well, I think, you know, there's another thing I talk about in the book about how it's very hard for us to understand in this day of pop fame of how anonymous many of these musicians came. I mean, it's not just her. People like Blind Blake and Blind Lemon Jefferson suffered from a huge amount of anonymity. What I mean is that, you know, they may have sold hundreds of thousands of recordings, some of them, you know, possibly into the millions, though we don't really know the sales statistics. But, you know, when they left that recording studio, they were black and they were poor. They received, chances are, a flat fee per side. If they had a royalty agreement, it's unlikely they ever saw any real money. And then just they disappeared into the land. I mean, they were probably trying to make their living. They were probably transient, like much of the African-American population at the time. And nobody was there to either care enough to document their lives or the kind of places they lived or what they did after they left the studio.
Well, let's hear it. Geechee Wiley recorded in 1930, The Last Kind Word Blues.
If I die, if I die in the German war, I want to send my body, send it to my mother-in-law. Baggy teal, please don't bear my soul. Just leave me out, let the buzzer see me go. When you see me coming, look across the rich man's field. And if I don't bring you flowers, I'll bring you both in.
It's Geechee Wiley, guitar and vocals, as recorded in 1930. One of the recordings featured on Alan Lowe's new audio compilation, American Pop and Audio History. And Alan, I guess we should say, if that sounds familiar to some of our listeners, one of the reasons maybe why it was included in that documentary on R. Crumb that was released a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's where I first heard it. As a matter of fact, I listened to that and I said, what is that song and where can I get it? But it's very, I thought it was very powerful. Yeah.
My guest is Alan Lowe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Alan Lowe, he's compiled a new 9-CD box set and companion book on American pop history. Alan, you're a saxophonist and composer, as well as being someone who now writes music histories and compiles music anthologies. I'm wondering how this new history of pop music that you've done has affected your own playing and composing.
It's interesting because I'm laughing because I remember I did a CD for Enja Records a few years ago. We haven't done anything since for Enja, but I remember right after that, it was in the middle of, I was starting to get into country music. And I decided I wanted to do kind of a hillbilly thing, jazz thing, but not in the sense of hillbilly jazz, like a Western swing thing. But I wanted to use certain kinds of older modal mountain type tunes, and I wanted to do them in some way that involved improvisation. And I remember meeting someone from the record company in New York and talking about it and saying, well, you know, I'm thinking for my next project I'd like to do, and I told him, and I got one of the blankest looks of my life, because as soon as you mention the word hillbilly music or country music to a jazz person, they just they think you're off on another planet. So it's probably retarded my professional development, my concern with other kinds of music, but I feel like it's been good for me personally. I haven't really done much recording or playing in the last 2 years, partly because I've been so tied up with my projects. But I what it's done is kind of gotten me away from that hermetical world of the jazz musician, which tends to say, you know, jazz is America's classical music, jazz is America's only music. And as much as I love jazz, and it's still the world to which I return frequently, I think there's a much bigger world of music out there, and this project has really exposed me to that.
One of your own CDs as a saxophonist is called the American Popular Song Project, and a lot of what you play on there is inspired by pop tunes throughout the 20th century. And one of them is a recording of Blue Moon, but your version of Blue Moon on this recording is inspired by Elvis's version of Blue Moon. And I really like what you've done with this. Why don't you say a couple of words about your recording, and then we'll hear it.
Well, I was listening, you know, as I was getting into this music, I bought a CD of the Sun Sessions of Elvis Presley, which for those who don't know, is the Sun Records was the record label in Memphis, Tennessee, which was the first label that Elvis recorded for. And amongst various versions of things which we know about, like That's All Right, Mama, and Blue Moon of Kentucky, which is a different song written by Bill Monroe, was this very odd version of the old Rodgers and Hart tune, Blue Moon, done with this kind of chicken-scratching accompaniment on the guitar. And Elvis, he never sings the bridge. He just keeps repeating it over and over, does this kind of a falsetto yell in it. And I just thought it was just one of the most beautiful things I'd ever heard. And I was determined, if and when I went into the studio next, to do a version of it that closely echoed what I'd heard Elvis do.
Alan Lowe produced the new 9-CD pop set, American Pop and Audio History, from Minstrel to Mojo, and he wrote the new companion book, American Pop. The book is on Cadenced, and the CD is on the Music and Arts label.